Thank you. I needed a jolt because the worst thing you can do is to be a keynote speaker after lunch. And I didn't know how I'll get my energized, and I couldn't find my PowerPoint. So I'm ready. Thank you. It's really an honor to be here. Cole, thank you for the invitation. Cole put me on their website, on their mailing list, and I'm getting now in the last month and a half the daily news clipping of everything religion, which I used to try to find myself. So it's a great thing. Thank you. I know Jeffrey already said it, that he's not a lawyer, and Robert says he's not a lawyer, but I must share with you, this is my second opportunity to speak to lawyers. Just as welfare reform and faith-based social services came to be an executive order, I was invited to speak to a large group of constitutional lawyers, much more elegant and posh place than this one, on top of a resort with beautiful amenities. And I started my lecture by saying, I don't know anything about the law. I know about social services. Finished my lecture. Oh, I should say that each and every one in the audience then at least once argued before the Supreme Court. One of them did it over 40 times. So as soon as I finished my talk, this lawyer raised his hand. I said, yes. He said, do you think it's constitutional? And I said, you ask me? You're the lawyers. So now I feel a little better. We are all ignorant. A few words. I'm a social worker, and I think I'm the only social worker in the audience. And my interest is in the interface between religion and social services and social welfare. I'm interested to know who is helping the needy, the poor. And I'm coming to this perspective from what Martin Marty, who was a famous theologian in Chicago Theological Seminary, used to say. Religion is the most powerful force in society. It has the greatest potential to heal and to kill. I'm interested in the healing part. What religion is doing to make people be better, to improve quality of life, to make civil society a better place to live in. And funnily enough, or not funnily enough, whenever I find something, and I do a large research and very rigorous, and reporters are coming to listen to me after 5 minutes, they say it's not interesting. We want some scandals. We want some dirty stuff. You tell us a religious does good things, not very interesting. So, be that as it may, this is what I'm studying. The lecture that I have here, I can talk for 5 hours straight. And I know I don't have the time, but a good friend of mine used to say that good academician can say everything in 5 minutes or 5 hours. I have 25, right? I'll do my best. But as a warning for our interpreter and the people who will follow me, I cannot follow all my slides. So I'm going to skip many slides, and I'll talk about the key issue that I'm interested. So what I want to say here, basically I have 2 points to make. I want to introduce some of you who are not local, and some of you who are local and don't think my way, about religion and welfare in the United States. And I only emphasize part because I don't have the time, and I really seriously can talk about it for hours. The second is I want to show that religious organization, and most importantly for my research congregation, are major community organization, and they're major participant in the provision of welfare to needy individuals and families. If after 25 minutes I did this, I'm very happy. Now, as I don't have a watch, I hope that the good fellow volunteer in the audience will tell me when I talk for 25 minutes so I know I have to converge. Otherwise, we'll be here till dinner. And I'm serious. So one thing about the United States is that it's a very religious country, though it's hard to see when you walk and talk. I'm originally not from the United States. I'm originally from Israel. And when I look at America from the perspective of an outsider, I used to watch Hollywood movies, read American books, and none of them prepare me to the level of religiosity in this society. It's a kind of a two realities that goes together, and it's hard to see them intersecting. People mentioned the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, but I'm talking about another study that they did, not the one that Robert mentioned. Basically, they find that 82% of Americans proclaim that religion is important or very important in their lives. Three quarters pray at least weekly, and 58% daily. It's a lot. Very few countries reach such level. They found that about 7 in 10 attend religious services monthly. Other studies say 5. Other studies say 6. So, to be on the safe ground, I'll say anywhere between 50 to 70% of Americans are members of religious congregation. They attend them monthly, and they are known by other members and the clergy. So why is it important to me? Because this study also found that those who are heavily invested in the congregation are volunteering more than any other people. Now, I want to emphasize one point about it. It's attending congregation, not believing. We have other study that shows that people who are high on faith but are not attending congregation are not active in volunteering and also in donating money. Robert gave you a reading list. I'll add to this one. Robert Putnam and David Campbell. David Campbell is a member of the Church of the Latter-day Saints. I hope I'm saying it correctly. And they published American Grace in 2010, which excellent book about the role of religion in civil society. And they show beyond doubt that attending religious congregation in America is highly related to being pro-social, to being generous. So, let's see if I can do it. In the top line here, I mentioned the secularization theory. In a nutshell, it says that as soon as society, and it's really a nutshell, it's much more complicated. As soon as society becomes industrialized, knowledge-based, advanced, technological, democratized, people tend to leave religion. People said, okay, religion is no longer relevant. This is not the case in the United States. Now, the finding here is about adults. Oh, I'm going the wrong direction. I apologize. I'm not good with technology. We did a study about 7-8 years ago of teenagers in America. Those who are between 11 and 18, and see the similarity. We found that 84% of the religion is important or very important in their lives. We found out that 2/3 attend congregation at least monthly. This is 11 to 18 years old. 42% of them are member of a youth group that is religiously related. When I found the statistics, I told my colleagues something must be wrong here. I don't think the youth in America is so religious. But they told me the statistics on other parts of the survey is really exactly on par with their national data. So I went to look for statistics about youth and religion. I found three studies that were not published. Some of them were done by the University of Michigan, some by the Department of Education. They found exactly the same as we found. So those numbers here are highly correlated with what you find in other studies, probably reflect some of the American reality. We also find that regarding risk behavior, youth who are attending congregation Youth say religion is important in their lives are less likely to engage in risk behaviors. Again, these findings were supported by other studies. I'm not telling you, Robert was very good to distinguish between correlation and causation. I'm not telling you there's a causation here. There can be many other reasons. But the fact is that the youth that either forced to come to congregation by the parents and therefore have caring parents, or somehow found themselves, or not acting out enough to be thrown out of congregations, whatever reason you want, those youth avoid risk behavior much more than most youth in society. But American religion is very interesting in many other ways, and here I'll be quite skimpy. I have much more to say about it. We don't have one group that is a majority of religion. There's no group in America that can say, we are the country. There's some group who try to do it. But when you look at the numbers, they're also minorities. The new study finds that 51% of Americans are Protestant. And if you know how many denominations they are, you know that they all feel themselves persecuted. Each and every group I talk with, to some degree, say they are plotting something against us. But it's also increased the energy that exists in religions. It's increased the innovation that we find in religion that you don't find in many other countries. I don't know what I did. Okay, it's coming. Okay. We have a large number of people who attend places of worship who don't do it in the same faith tradition as their parents. It's quite common for people to search when they leave, when they get married. I used to have a cartoon that followed it that one of the church in Philadelphia put a huge billboard that says, shopping for congregation, and they show somebody with a cart like in a mall, try us. And in America, many people who move look for the congregation that they've been member before and say, it's not it, and keep looking. Among the people who are married, more than a third are married to people from another faith tradition, including myself. I'll skip this. I'm among lawyers, and I'm a little worried to put these slides, but I'll do it anyhow. When the first people came to the United States, they came mostly from England. Coming from England, they followed the British law. And religion was part of the government. That was the case, more or less, until 1776 and 50 years later in different first colonies, then states. The clergy at that time, and Robert mentioned Roger Finke, who was a colleague of mine and friend, had another book that make wonderful analogy and cases of religion before independence. Most clergy were paid by the city, and they brought the word of God onto people. I hope what I'm saying is clear, because otherwise I'll have to talk for another 10 minutes. In 1776, Madison and Jefferson in Virginia said, you know what? Why should tax money pay for people's religion? And in Virginia, they pass a law for the state that says, we are not establishing any religion. Government will not support religion, and you can pray, worship, whatever you want. I know I'm simplifying it, and every lawyer in the room probably cringe, but in a nutshell, it's good enough. What it did is the clergy, it took 50 years until the last state, which was Massachusetts, accepted it and make it a state law similar to Virginia. Clergy claimed, if you do this transition, havoc will happen. Lawlessness, drunkenness. Where will people get the morality from? But it passed. And clergy is now faced a new reality. They have to make their message meaningful for people. They have to talk to people, persuade them to come, and make them willing to pay for the building and the clergy services. That was a revolution. Not all clergy succeeded. But what we know is that the rate of participation in worship services climbed up dramatically. The variety of religious groups, the number of people, congregation, and the energy in congregation changed dramatically. Now I'm going to... This is not cooperating with me. Okay? Many of you, the American, know the Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. This is dramatic for this country when it came. This is now for the whole country. And everyone on the panel except Rick and many in the audience can talk better than me about the separation of church and state. So I'll skip the rest of it. But this is not very cooperating. Okay. Okay, this is part of what I mentioned. And what happened here, when I ask student, who provided welfare in colonial era? They all raise their hand and they say the church. If you believe in it, you're wrong. Churches did not involve in welfare until 1850. Because churches at that time brought the word of God to people. They did not involve themselves. Only in Virginia, the people who were overseers of the poor happened to be the Anglican clergy reverend. Now, what we find today in congregations, and I'm focusing on congregation, that they have a strong culture of we have to do good. Since 1850, every American congregation believe, and the member and the clergy assume that it's part of the role as a religious congregation to care for the others. And again, I would emphasize, being high on faith does not do it. You have to have the intersection of faith and congregation. Congregation also provides safe space for small groups. We have very interesting congregation where people who otherwise feel marginalized come together and find mutual support. In essence, United States is the only country, by the way, that was formed on two pillars of Protestantism and capitalism. The first settlers either came to make money and go back to England, or to establish the kingdom of God on earth. That's very unique, and it's explained a lot of the American development. Again, 20 minutes that I spare you. We have a fundamental distrust in government. More than any country in the world, we believe that government is not a good or efficient entity. If you watch a candidate for any office, not just for president, each of them promised two things. I lower taxes, I make government small. It's ironic that after 9/11, we forced the government to take control of the safety of airport against government willingness. But as a whole, whenever we have a chance, we believe that private sector way more efficient than government, and government is not on our side. We're also still an immigrant society. We bring many more people to the country. Consequently, we don't have multi-generational families. And where I come from welfare, we have two major traditions. The European one, where government is the major provider of welfare, with some recent retreat in the last 20 years, and the family responsibility tradition, which you see strongly in Asian countries, but in many other countries. We don't have either. We put the burden on the individual. If you're in need, you are the one who is responsible for your family or yourself. I put it as an economic individualism. I should have been here. Economic individualism means that it's one of the major values in America. In one of my studies, we offer people 20 statements to ask them to what extent they agree with it. This was number one. You're responsible for the well-being of yourself and your family. From welfare perspective, this is challenging. I came and asked myself, who is responsible for helping the needy? And I went and asked lots of people. This is 6 o'clock in the evening. You didn't eat the whole day. You don't have work. You come home and you find that you've been evicted. The landlord throw all your stuff on the sidewalk. What do you do? In Asian culture, you go to your family. In Israel, where I come from, European tradition, government will help you. People look at me like, oh, I'll go to the church. And from where I came from, that was a puzzling answer. The church, is that a source of welfare? And I started talking with my colleagues. And they say, no, it's not like this. And then I started reading the textbooks on welfare. And almost every one of them said, our beliefs and our values of helping the poor come from religious heritage. And then it died. From there on, it's a totally secular experience in our textbooks. But who is giving food to hungry people? Who is helping children when parents have to work from 7 in the morning to 6 in the evening and school is only caring for them for 7 hours? That was my questions to people, and slowly, there was some census congregation. Now, I have to tell you, I'm not a religious person. I'm not a member of a congregation, so it was not a pleasing answer from where I come from. I'll skip this and come to it a little later, if you'll excuse me. It's not well organized, and my apologies, I said to the interpreters. Okay. After doing two small studies on congregation, not so small, but relatively small, I find out that congregations are doing an amazing amount of welfare work. But in research, every time that you come with a publication or a findings, people find holes in it. They tell you why you're wrong. Because your sample is like this, and you didn't cover this. And how do you know about this? Now, congregations in America, I'm sure in a few other countries, but not in most developed economies and democracies, are not required to register with anyone. You can decide that you want to start a congregation, you can start it. You don't even have to have theological education for this. What it means, we didn't know how many congregations exist. So how can I say to my colleagues that my sample is representative? I got a nice grant, and we tried to do a census of all of Philadelphia congregation. I will summarize the methods in less than a minute. It was so weird that the literature didn't have a definition of what is a congregation. We have beautiful heuristic explanation. But to go to a building and say, is this a congregation or not, was very difficult. There was a question, if students meet together to worship, is this a congregation? If prisoners are worshiping, is it a congregation? Then we couldn't find all of them, because they are not registered anywhere. I sent interviewers to walk every street in Philadelphia, talk with people, and mark every sign possible. It took 3 years. We find that in Philadelphia, there are 2,100 congregations. I managed to interview 1,400 of them. And I can tell you that we did analysis when we have 400, 700, 1,000 something, and there were no real changes. There was some variation. So we know we are representing what exists. We found more small congregation than anyone else ever included in any study. So this is the study that's not... One point that I want to make quickly, congregation are the most prevalent organization in any community. This is not my finding. This is John Orr from Los Angeles after the Rodney King incidents and the riots. He went to measure, and I read it for people who can't see it very well and for the translators. He found in an average of 35 religious congregation and 12.5 religiously affiliated nonprofit congregation per square mile, far more than the number of gasoline stations, liquor store, and supermarket combined. I said, wow. So I did the same in West Philadelphia. The area had anywhere between 6 to 13 square miles. If you take the train station, the university, and the parks, it's 13 miles. If you deduct them, it's 6, but we play with the 13 miles, square miles. We find 33.3 congregations per square mile. The longest distance you can walk in Philadelphia, not in West Philadelphia, Philadelphia, between one congregation and another is about a kilometer, 0.8 miles. And this is because there's a huge park between them. This is West Philadelphia. The bigger the square, the more congregation there are in it. It's really the organization that most people are a member of and are most prevalent in any community. One of my doctoral students took a small census tract in North Philadelphia, only 1.13 square mile. It's next to Temple University. And what she finds, I hope this is clear, but I'll make it clear if it doesn't. Out of 62 organizations, 77% of them were religious. Only 23% were not religious. And about half of them were religious when they were incorporated. And 66% are congregation. So out of this 77%, the majority are congregation. Anywhere you go in America, I'll quickly show you what you see here is the map of Philadelphia and all the congregation. That's not, but this is easier to understand. The darker it is, the more Latinos live in this area. And the dots, the circles, are religious Latino congregation. This is same things. The darker it is, the more African-American live there. The more dots you find. Congregations are following people, but they are not running away from social problems. Of all the other social and community organizations, they are where problems are. Most arts organizations, community organizations, when we plot them, we find a clear tendency that they're in center city and on major highways. When we plot the congregation, as you saw a few minutes ago, they're everywhere where people live. This is the organization that people build where they are. I'll skip the organizational characteristic because it's not relevant. It's relevant, but we don't have the time for this. If you want, you can ask me after the break, or in the break, sorry. All right, so what did we find? The first thing we find, 93% of the congregation reported that they do at least one social program to improve the quality of life of people. Now, I'm being asked often, are they serving members or non-members? And my answer is, who care? When you have needy people, the question is, who helped them? Not where they come from. But I can tell you, I'll tell you in a few minutes, I'll give you the numbers, the majority of the beneficiaries are not from the congregation. But if you have somebody who is out of work and you help them, you help society. It doesn't matter if it's a member of your congregation. If you have somebody who has a problem with drugs and needs support, it doesn't matter. Oh, what does it say? The 5 minutes or conclude? Oh, I asked for 5 minutes warning. Okay. Conclusion. It's okay. We found that congregation are eagerly engaged in helping people. They use the majority of the money that goes for providing the services from their own resources. Very few get public money. The culture of helping the poor is very strong in congregation. They are really the welfare agents of our society. People ask me, is it to proselytize and gain new members? The answer is no. They try not to proselytize. But it helped them be better. You put the word Christian, Mormon, Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Muslim, Baptist, whatever you want. People feel that they act their religion much better when they provide services for others. Do I have 1 minute? 1 minute. In 1996, we change our welfare in the country. We make it way more draconian than it was ever before. The only welfare program that guaranteed continual income to single mother was limited to 5 years. In it was a provision that says, we also change the way we provide services with religious organizations. We encourage the government to contract with religious organizations for provision of services, welfare services. And we do not require of them not to be religious. Until then, if you provided services with public money, you have to pretend that you're not religious. It's a major shift in the way we provide welfare, and it's increased the number of religious providers in giving welfare. And my last word, this is an increasing trend in America, but something that has historical root. There are two communities who care for the needy in our country. My camp, social workers, and religious organizations, religious congregations. And my mission is to link those communities as much as possible. Thank you.